For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
We are in Joshua 3 through 4. We're going to be reading about the crossing of the Jordan River. My name's Josh. I normally teach South CT, and I'm excited to be here with you guys tonight. Yeah. All right, so yesterday, Slam was talking to us about how they sent spies to go and look at what was going on beyond the Jordan River in the land of Canaan. Now, their sights are set on the city called Jericho. Jericho was very important because in order to have safe access to the rest of the land of Canaan, they were going to have to take Jericho down. So they were looking at this area. They were spying out this area. They knew that that was going to be their first big battle. But before they can do any of that, there's one more thing they have to do. They have to cross a river. And so, we read that early in the morning, Joshua and all the Israelites set out from Acacia Grove and went to the Jordan, where they camped before crossing over. All right, so you can see here on the map where they would have been. The Jordan River, in case you know you can't see this well, that's the blue thing in the middle. That's the Jordan River. And you can see Jericho and all these different major cities of Canaan are on the left-hand side. So they're on the edge of the land which God has given them and where they're going to have to go. And what we read is that they camped there before they crossed over. This word, this phrase, to cross over, is used 21 times in Joshua 3 and Joshua 4. There's two whole chapters devoted to the crossing of this river. I mean, think about it. Joshua is about a military campaign. It's about a battle against this evil group of nations. There's all these other things involved, but yet two chapters get given to the crossing of a river. And if nothing else, what that should tell us is that we've reached a defining moment for the nation of Israel. This must be super important. And you might be thinking to yourself, I mean, how important can that really be? I mean, they're just crossing a river, right? And you say that as if you are an expert in crossing rivers. I'm sure many of you have forded many rivers. No, of course you haven't. We're city folk. We're not the river crossing type. Crossing a river is difficult. It's dangerous in of itself. But really what's happening here is so much more than the crossing of a river. God is using the crossing of this river to teach them something about what it's going to be like to relate to him on the other side. Because for the nation of Israel, everything is about to change. We read in verse 2 that after 3 days, the officers went throughout the camp giving orders to the people. They said, when you see the Ark of the Covenant, you are to move out from your positions and follow it. Then you will know which way to go because you've never been this way before. That's right. We have to appreciate what was changing for them at this juncture. Really, everything. Everything was going to be different once they crossed this river. He says, you've never been this way before. It's not like the Israelites were a soft people, right? I mean, they'd been slaves in Egypt. They've been living in the wilderness for 40 years, surviving all these things, fighting off marauding bands, going through, you know, seeing all sorts of miracles that God had done. They'd been through some rough stuff, right? They'd had some pain. But they were not a warlike people. They were not a military people. They didn't know how to fight. And what they were doing, what they were crossing over to do, was to fight a war. And so defining moment is when you decide what you're going to be. It's a consequential decision where you know that if we do this, if I take this step, then I can't go back. Nothing will ever be the same if I take this step. And so they're facing a consequential decision. On one hand, they have the desert. Remember, they were here 40 years ago. 40 years ago. They looked into the land of Canaan, and they looked at all the things that were there, and they said, no thanks. We'll take our chances in the desert. And that's exactly what they did. They lived in the desert. They made that choice. They lived that life. And now on the other side of this river is war. Everything is about to change. And before we begin unpacking the story and walking through it, I want to make this connection for us. God brought Israel to this point. And we're going to see that he speaks to them and says, take this very seriously as you prepare to take this step. And there's a relationship here to what we should be looking for in our spiritual lives, because God is going to mark out defining moments in your life as well. there's going to be many non-consequential moments, right? I'm not talking about like when you first got your Starbucks gold status or something like that. Or maybe when like you went to your first 21 Pilots concert or something like that. Those are, yeah. And I say that as a guy who drinks Starbucks and thinks the new 21 Pilots album is okay. So, but what I'm saying is that it's not, we're not talking about inconsequential things like that. There are decisions that God will bring you to in your spiritual life, crossroads, where what you do here matters. And it will change the way that you relate to God. It will change what happens from this point forward. And we need to know how to prepare for those moments. And that's what Joshua 3 and 4, I really believe, has to teach us. All right. We read that Joshua told the people, so they're camped in front of the river. And Joshua tells the people, consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do amazing things among you. Ooh, ominous, right? Consecrate yourselves. That's a fancy word, but what it really means is to prepare yourself, or to thoughtfully prepare yourself, or to set yourself apart for a purpose. Really what he's saying is, you guys should get ready. God's going to do something pretty crazy tomorrow, actually. And you need to get ready and be prepared. And it makes sense why you would need to take the time to get ready before encountering a critical decision like the one that they were about to make. Getting ready can look like adding up the factors. I mean, when you think about it, we don't do ourselves any favors by not looking at the real challenges that are facing us. Oh yeah, their challenges were real. Jericho was real. The war that was coming was real. The challenge of setting up a life in a new land was real. All of these things were real. The temptations to assimilate and become like the people there and to engage in things like child sacrifices and the kind of stuff that those people were into, believe it or not, that was all there. So the challenges were real. The changes were also real. Back in the desert, God had supernaturally provided for them in a number of different ways. For one thing, they basically had food for free with no work every single morning. God would supernaturally provide food. Also, when it came to how to follow God, where to go, what to do, there was a pillar of fire at night that guided them, and there was a pillar of cloud during the day. So they lived this really supported life in many ways in the desert where God provided for them in special ways. But after they crossed the river, guess what? All that stuff goes away. They have to start providing for their own food. They have to start going to God and asking for guidance on a regular basis. They need to look back at what God has done and what God has said and start making their future decisions based on that, not some burning, you know, fire pillar in the sky. And when you think about it, again, this is something for us that when we are looking at changes that are coming in our lives, there might be big changes in the way that we relate to God as well. When it comes to the issue of guidance, you know, maybe you're used to being around certain people. Maybe you have certain friends. Maybe you have leaders in your life who have really helped you. It's possible that God might lead you into a new stage of life where that person's not going to be there anymore. You're not going to have that kind of guidance. Maybe there's a relationship, someone you've always been close with. And maybe because of circumstantial reasons, maybe you guys are going different directions in life. And God's going to say, I want you to carry forward, even though they're not coming too. And man, that's what I'm talking about. We have to look changes like that in the eye. And what the Bible says we ought to do when we're looking at all the things that are facing us is we need to do something called counting the cost. Check out what Jesus says in Luke 14. He says, suppose you want to build a tower, you know, as you do. Won't you first sit down and estimate the cost to see if you have enough money to complete it? Right, yeah, you don't want to start a building project if you're not sure you have adequate funds, right? And so we don't do ourselves any favors. There's nothing spiritual about blasting forward and just being like, you know, whatever, man, I'm just going to trust God with everything. God says, no, no, no. Jesus said to his disciples, he said, slow down. Think about it. He says, you know, if you follow me, there might be a cost which you need to count. For instance, your family and friends. You might lose their approval if you choose to go after me with your whole heart. So he told his disciples, he said, you guys should think about that. You should think about what that might mean if you throw it all in with me. He said to one guy, he was like, you know what? It's not going to work for you to be wealthy and to follow me. It's not going to work. And so he told that guy, he said, you should think about that. Decide if you're ready to give that up before you follow me. And so God tells us to count the cost. However, counting the cost looks like more than just looking at the challenges and the changes. It also looks like looking at God. Because yeah, the challenges are real, but guess what? God is real too. God is real too. And so if we're going to do the math, if we're going to add things up appropriately, we need to look at all the factors. And so what happens here, you know, getting ready, preparing yourself, and I'm sure that this is what the Israelites were doing that night. As they thought about the things that God had done, as they thought about the promises he'd made, everything they'd seen, what they'd seen with their parents, all of that, they're turning it over. They're thinking about what's on the other side, you know, what they know the land is like, and they're thinking to themselves, is it worth it? They're wrestling, they're praying, they're trying to reach a point where they decide, is God more trustworthy than the challenges that are in front of me? Which one of these things, how does the equation balance out? And this really is, in some ways, like doing math. It's like the math of faith. Because when you think about what you're doing is you're adding together what God has promised. You're adding in how he's come through for you in the past. That's another part of the equation, an important part of the equation. Maybe you're subtracting some of the costs where you're like, that will be hard to go without that. That will be tough if this kind of opposition is what I face. So you're subtracting that. And then, of course, you're dividing by things like your limited perspective. That's actually a step that we often forget to do. We have to factor in our limited perspective, that, you know, we just don't know what's going to happen. We often make all these plans based on the flawed assumption that we have much more control than we actually do. And so we need to factor that in, that we really don't have that much control. That there's a lot of things that could totally throw my plan for my life completely off. But if there is a God, if there's a real God, then what a mistake would be to not factor him into this equation, because that would change everything. Psalm 37, verse 4 says, delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. Wow, that's a powerful verse. That doesn't mean he gives you whatever you want. What it means is that he gives you the desires of your heart, because often the thing that we say we want, like as an example, like you ever wanted to date someone, dated that person, and then later been like, that was not the desire of my heart, right? Like, often we want something, but you know, you didn't really want that person, did you? You wanted something beyond that person. You wanted, you know, what you hoped that person would be. And so what God says is that he wants to give us the desires of our heart. But notice here, he says that there's a condition here. He says, commit your way to the Lord, trust in him, and then he will act. And so there's times where there is the necessity of a decision on our part, a decision of faith beforehand, if we want to see God do something powerful. Joswald Sanders, yeah, it's funny. There's actually a period after the J, but you know. He says this in his book on Joshua. He says, we often fix the time for the display of his power. We consecrate, and then he acts. It's on man's side that the windows of blessing are bolted. I think that's really true. I think that in my life, there have been times where I've wondered, you know, why isn't God acting? Why isn't God acting? Why isn't God acting? Only to realize that the Lord told me, the Lord has been saying to me, take this step first. Count the cost first. You know, think about this first. You know, if you really want to see me work in this area, here's the first thing you need to do. And I'm just sitting there demanding that he show me something more. All right, so we move on in verse 6. He says, Joshua said to the priests, take up the Ark of the Covenant and pass ahead of the people. And so they took it up and they went ahead of them. This leads us to the second principle, the second thing that we can learn about what it means to come to a defining moment in our spiritual lives. We see that in their case, God was going to lead the way. He says, take up the Ark of the Covenant. Now that may be a word that doesn't mean a lot to you guys, but the Ark, without getting too intense about this, the Ark was an ornate box covered in gold. And you're like, that's cool. It's weird they put it in the river first, but that's cool. But what this thing was, it was a symbol of God's relationship to the people of Israel. It really symbolized his presence with them. And it was often kept in this tent away from everybody else. So the fact that they took it out of the tent and then walked it into the river first says something. The presence of God was going before the people of Israel. Deuteronomy 31 teaches us that the Lord himself will go before you. He will never leave you nor forsake you. Do not be afraid and do not be discouraged. Man, that sounds a lot like Joshua chapter 1, doesn't it? It's pretty cool. Yeah, God will go before you. When we come to a defining moment in our spiritual lives, we need to understand that God is not just like your mom who follows you around and picks up after you. Though hopefully your mom doesn't do that anymore. But when you were a kid, your mom would follow you around, you know, you'd just be throwing things places and she would just pick up after you. And we often think that that's what God does. It's like we're kind of tottering around and God's there to come in if we make a mistake, right? You know, if our walk with God gets a little bit off track or if something goes wrong, God comes in and he corrects us, right? It's true that God reacts to the things that we do, but God also goes ahead of us. And if we choose to trust him with our lives, and what we find is that God prepares the way before us. I can't tell you guys how many times I've been daunted by a difficult conversation, or I've not known what to do in a certain situation, and I'm like, I don't know how this is going to go. And then I go into it, trusting God, kind of trusting God, only to find that he has softened that person's heart, that he's already been working with these people. And I realize I'm not here to change how people think or to do something that I can't do. I'm here to just get behind what God is already doing. And so God does that. God goes ahead. God prepares. When I was 18 and I moved to Columbus was the last place on earth I wanted to be. I was living overseas. I didn't want to come back here. I didn't have friends in Columbus. I had friends elsewhere, just not in Columbus. And I didn't want to come back to this country, and I didn't want to come back to that city. But when I got there, with the intention of following God, but freaked out, one of the things that amazed me is that people that I didn't know, the guys that I moved in with in that ministry house, it was like God had prepared them. It was like he had fired them in a furnace just for the purpose of helping me grow spiritually. My first roommate was this guy named Alex Francis, who was this, like, I don't know, we couldn't be more different. He was just like this, like, wild, kind of crass dude. He'd recently come to Christ. I'd grown up in a Christian home. And we'd hang out and talk. And, you know, I soon learned as I got to know that guy that the Lord prepared this dude for me. I mean, God also prepared me for him. But the point is that I had no idea what provisions were waiting for me on the other side of that door. But this is what God does. He, when we let him lead the way, he also goes before us and prepares the way. And the Lord said to Joshua, "Today I will begin to exalt you in the eyes of Israel so that they may know that I am with you as I was with Moses. Tell the priests who carry the Ark of the Covenant that when you reach the edge of the Jordan's waters, go and stand in the river." Joshua said to the Israelites, "Come here and listen to the words of the Lord your God. This is how you will know the living God is among you, and that he will certainly drive out before you the peoples of Canaan. See, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all the earth will go into the Jordan ahead of you. And as soon as the priests who carry the Ark of the Lord of all the earth," he repeats it again, a lot of repetition in the book of Joshua, "set foot in the Jordan, its waters flowing downstream will be cut off and will stand up in a heap." What? God will part the waters for you. So when the people broke camp to cross the Jordan, the priests carrying the Ark of the Covenant went ahead with them. Now, the Jordan River is at flood stage during the harvest. So the time of this crossing, you know, the people are probably thinking to themselves, like, okay, we're going to build boats. Maybe Joshua knows of, like, a place where the river is, like, really thin. And they get to the banks of the river and they realize, this is like, it's harvest time, the river is overflowing, and there is no way we can take our families and all the things we own across this river. Now, because we're from Columbus, we're used to, when we think of a river, we think of like the pathetic little Scioto, right? And so when you're imagining the Jordan River, you're thinking to yourself like, oh, does it have those little fish statues on the sides, you know, and Like, is it, are there just like dead raccoons floating in it? No. No. The Jordan is not the biggest river in the world, but it's a monster compared to the Scioto. Take a look at this. Yeah. And actually, that's in modern-day Israel where they've dammed the rivers. So it would have been easily twice that size, both in terms of its intensity and also in its width. Back in ancient, in the time of Joshua. So they're looking at the river. You know, no one's thinking of Jericho anymore. They're just looking at the river. And the priests, you can imagine, the priests are holding the Ark of the Covenant, the most sacred object in all of Israel. They're putting one foot in front of the other. The entire nation is walking in one silly-looking procession up to the banks of this river, right? Imagine how stupid that would have looked. They're walking up to the river, and they get to the edge of the water. And you know, at this point, if you're one of the priests, you got to be thinking to yourself, what is going to happen when I step foot in this river? I mean, if you step foot in that river that we just saw, you know, you'd be shooting down the river. I mean, like, goodbye, Ark, and it would all be gone. What's going to happen next? And then another thought that you might have is, why can't God just part the water first? Why do we have to walk into the river in order for the waters to part? I think that's a pretty good question. Oswald Sanders says that there are some things that God cannot and will not do for us, although he will supply all the power and all the grace necessary, the initiative lies with us. So God had told them exactly what he was going to do. And then he said, as soon as your feet touch the water, that's when this is going to happen. But he left that crucial piece in their hands. You know, the hard part, parting the water. He didn't say, you know, Israel needs to go in and somehow part the waters themselves. He's like, no, that's supernatural. You leave that part up to me. What's your part? He says, you have to put your feet in the water. You just have to go and actually step in to that raging river. And this is the way it works with God. Where God gives us meaningful choices, concrete steps that demonstrate faith. What does it mean to have faith? You know, people sometimes think of faith as if it's like this like glowing aura that you have. Like it's like, you know, some people got it, some people don't. It's like an intuition of some kind. But we've been talking about how faith is much more of an informed decision, right? And so faith has action attached to it by necessary. If I really believe something, I'm going to act on what I believe. And so God sets out for us real steps of faith. And it's very important for us to have a good sense in our minds of what our part is when it comes to following God and what God promises to do. There's actually a number of different things that God will not do for you. There are things that God probably, in most cases, won't do. For instance, he's not going to brush your teeth. He's not going to do that. You can't be like, oh no, gingivitis, God did this to me. No, you're like, you have to brush your teeth. He's not going to ask a girl out on a date for you. Some of you are like, well, I'm doomed. Some guy was like, not me. Yeah, he's not going to do that. God's not going to open up your mouth to speak. He's not going to pry open your jaws and like take your face and like make you talk, right? He's not going to do that. God's not going to make you have a good attitude. You know, if you're sitting there being like, you know, I'm in a bad mood, like, you know, God, change me. You know what I mean? It's like, no. You can make a choice about the kind of attitude that you have. God's not going to think and pray for you. He didn't make it that way. He's made it so that that's something which you can choose to do. You choose to think. Counting the cost, praying, taking things to God, that is our part in our relationship with God. God has given that for us to do. God will not exercise faith on our behalf. Now, are we saying that God will never act just totally apart from us? Like he's always waiting for us to do our part? That's not what I mean. There have been times where I've done literally nothing. I've been a scoffer. I've been a hater of what God was doing. And God did something like just to spite me, it seems, right? So there's times where God will act completely independently from us. But if we're waiting for God to take our feet and put it in the water for us, oftentimes we'll be waiting forever. Because God has made us as human beings with the ability to choose, and he engages us and he gives us the choice whether to say yes or whether to say no. And this is part of what it means to be a human being, which we're pretty sure Shane qualifies. We think he is a human being. This is the critical difference between a human being and, say, a squash. You know, both of these things are living organisms, right? Both of these things are, they have cell replication and all that stuff going on. But there's a massive difference between Shane and a squash. Nope. Namely, the ability to choose, the ability to reason, to think, you know, to listen to what God has to say and then to decide for myself, am I going to believe God? Well, we read that as soon as the priests who carried the ark reached the Jordan and their feet touched the water's edge, they took that first step that God asked them to take, the water from upstream stopped flowing. Oh my God. It actually happened. It piled up in a great heap, a great distance away, so the people crossed opposite of Jericho. So it happened. You know, we only get a couple sentences here, but try to step into this for a moment. Imagine how amazing this would have been to watch those rushing waters stop like a car hitting a tree and to be pulled back. Some of you are thinking to yourself like, oh, so God's a waterbender. That's cool. And, you know, it is possible that God just, you know, supernaturally peeled the waters back. There are a few other interesting things here that we can note. Because God also can perform miracles by natural means. One thing that's really interesting about the Jordan River Valley is that it is actually one of the most earthquake-prone areas of the world. All those different lines that you see, those are fault lines where earthquakes can happen. And so there's actually multiple times in recorded history where there has been a landslide into the Jordan River, which has dammed part of the river, and then the water has dried up for one time as long as a day. And so there's some kind of historical precedent for this. But the point here is that no matter what happened, you know, whether God just parted the waters, you know, with, again, whether he waterbended the waters, which, you know, he made water, he can certainly do that, or whether he used something like this, the point is that what we see here is a miracle. And he was teaching the people of Israel something by doing this. Never, from this point forward, they would never be able to doubt that God wanted them in that land. Because he opened up the way in a way that only God could do. Well, we have one more lesson to learn here. It's found in chapter 4. So let's hop forward a little bit to verse 8 in chapter 4. We read that they took the 12 stones in the middle of the Jordan according to the number of the tribes of the Israelites. There are 12 tribes. And as the Lord had told Joshua, they carried them over with them to their camp. Joshua set up these 12 stones. Now, to give you an idea, these stones would have been riverbed stones. So big stones that had been shaped by the waters. They wouldn't have looked like anything that you would have seen on the land. And so they carried these 12 stones, and they set them up in the middle of the Jordan River. And then they took another 12 stones. We'll see what they did with those in a moment. But now the priests who carried the ark, they remained standing in the middle of the Jordan. And the people hurried over. And as soon as all of them had crossed, the ark of the Lord and the priests came to the other side while the people watched. And no sooner had their feet set on the dry ground than the waters of the Jordan returned to their place and ran at flood stage as before. And then Joshua set up a Gilgal, 12 stones that they had taken out of the Jordan. And he said to the Israelites, in the future, when your descendants ask, what do these stones mean? Tell them, Israel crossed the Jordan on dry ground. For the Lord your God dried up the Jordan before you until you had crossed over. He did this so that all the peoples of the earth might know that the hand of the Lord is powerful, and so that you might always fear or have reverence for the Lord your God. Yeah. You know, when God brings you to a defining moment in your life, part of our responsibility is to remember what God has done at that moment. Because there'll be times in the future that might challenge our commitment that we made at that moment. Maybe this is when you first let Christ into your life. Maybe it's when you first decided to give your whole life to Jesus, to serve God. There'll be moments where that commitment is tested, and you will need to look back at what God did that first made you think, you know what, I can't do anything but serve God with my life. And you'll have to ask yourself, why did I make that choice? And for the Israelites, this monument would be a constant reminder, not just to them, but to their children, and even to the peoples of Canaan. I love that point here. He says that all the peoples of the earth might know. One thing we're not going to read about in the book of Joshua is how there were actually people groups among the Canaanites who said, we want in. Yeah, Rahab was one, but there was another people group called the Gibeonites. And the Gibeonites, they heard what God did. They saw what happened here, and they said, that's the God that we want to serve. We want to be a part of Israel too. And so God was not just serving Israel at this moment, but he was drawing people to himself. And of course, when God does miracles in our lives, that's also part of the game. It's not just for you, but it's also for the people watching. But this idea of setting up a monument, setting up a memorial, this is the last thing I want to talk about because, you know, we do this too, right? This is the World War I monument in Kansas City. It's this massive building. And World War I is an example of something you don't always think of. But when you see a huge building like this, you're like, whoa, like what is that tower for? And it reminds you like, wow, yeah, that's a significant part of our history. Yeah, so there's a lot of different ways to do this, to make a memorial or to try to remember what God has done. I mean, a lot of people get tattoos to commemorate things that, you know, meant a lot to them in their lives. These are both ferret memorial tattoos, tattoos that memorialize people's dead ferrets, and there is an entire internet community of people that have ferret memorial tattoos. So I want you guys to wrap your mind around that for a moment. But in all seriousness, we need to learn to do this in our spiritual lives as well. And, you know, I think there's a lot of ways to do this. It doesn't have to look like setting up a pile of stones. I mean, carving something in a tree, if that's your thing, then sure, go do it. But I actually think that times like this, you know, being here at a place like Epic, we have an opportunity to use this retreat as a memorial. Because this happens once a year. And you have an opportunity this week to actually look back at what God has done this previous year, to factor it up, to think about it, to do the math, you know, what has God done? What has God changed in my life? What is he showing with me? Where am I at now? In fact, some of us might be approaching a defining moment, right? And so we have a chance to look forward and say, based on what I know about God and based on what he's done, you know, what is the future going to look like for me? And we can do this not just by ourselves, but I think sharing stories with each other. How many of you guys know the stories of the different people in your home church where you know how they came to know Christ? Or maybe why they care about Jesus at all, right? Do you know that? I think you should know that about the people around you. And we should be a memorial for each other in that sense. You know, we can actually be a part of reminding each other of what God has done. So think about this, you know, set up a memorial, find a way to remember what God has done in your life as well. Well, I want to just draw a few conclusions here to wrap this up. Firstly, have you ever experienced anything like this? Have you ever come to a defining moment in your spiritual life? I think a lot of us can think of some key moments, some things that God has brought us to. I mean, receiving Jesus into your life is as defining as it gets, right? I mean, making the choice to say, God, I believe that you're real and I want a relationship with you. I mean, that's a Jordan River for sure. But other ones can be things like deciding to live for Jesus. You know, and these things aren't necessarily the same. To receive Jesus into your life, to receive forgiveness versus saying, God, have my life. Use me. I want my life to be about you. That's a different decision. And I sense that there's probably a lot of us here tonight who have not yet made that decision. You know, we are on the precipice here. We're looking at the waters, right? We're still on step one where God is saying, get ready. Get ready because there will be a chance to put your feet in the water. And if you do, you will see God act in amazing ways. Facing major opposition could be another defining moment. The first time someone really tries to stop you from following God. A lot of us haven't experienced that. Some of you have. But that can be one of those moments where we have to decide, you know, what am I going to be about? What is my life going to be like? You know, am I going to just kind of pretend to be whoever people want me to be, or am I actually going to be what God says I am? It's important. Making a major life decision. This could be, you know, where you're going to go to college. It could be how you're going to spend your time. It could be lots of different things. Speaking up for God. For some of us, this is also a defining moment. The first time that you realize, man, God doesn't want just to give to me. He wants to use me. And if I opened up my mouth, what would he say through me? But, you know, these are just some examples. I think that there could be many other examples of this as well. But I want you to think about this. Have you come to any defining moments in your spiritual life? Then what would it look like to prepare for these moments? I think another point I wanted to make is that defining moments come for groups as well as individuals. It's easy for us to always think about this in a really individualistic way, to think about, okay, like, yeah, like, what's God doing in my life? But remember, this was all the people of Israel. They made this choice together, right? And so there's times when you realize that, you know, God has brought me to a crossroads, and it's not just me, but it's my friend. It's both of us. We're going to make this choice together. I know of people, I have good friends who, when they were deciding that they were going to go all out for God, they knew, they were like, I'm never going to make it unless this guy comes too. And that guy had the same thought where he was like, you know, I can't see myself being able to follow through here unless I got these two people with me as well. And so people can sense this as a group too. God can bring you to this as a community. I think for home churches, there can be defining moments where, you know, you're looking around the room and you realize, you know, man, maybe this isn't all that good. Maybe there's some problems here, right? And at some point, you realize that if we don't decide soon what this group is going to be about, then this isn't going to be a group at all. This is not going to last. And so God brings us these moments as a community and not just as individuals. And then finally, we should think about this. We should count the cost of crossing over, of crossing the river into a new experience of faith, but we should also count the cost of not crossing over as well. For the people of Israel, this would have looked like staying in the desert. And the desert was not a good place to live. Could they live there? Yes. Did God provide them for them there? Yes. But why would you want to live in the desert? One of the astronauts who's been to the moon once visited this area of the world, the Sinai Peninsula, and he said, this is what it looks like. and he said, this is the closest thing to the surface of the moon I've ever seen on Earth. And so if we don't choose to cross over, if we don't choose to trust God and take that step, you know, this could look like settling for a life that's only a shadow of what it could be if we really entrusted ourselves to God. And this is always how it works with God. You know, God, we think about these scary steps of faith that God wants us to take. Here's the funny thing. God never wants to take as much as he wants to give. And if God wants to take something out of your hands, it is only ever to put far much more in. And I'm not talking about material things. I'm talking about spiritual blessing. I'm talking about things that will actually fulfill you. I'm talking about things that will make your life worthwhile. He will give to you more than he takes. God is a giver. We can trust God with our lives. And he wants to take you out of the desert and into the land of promise. And that's one of the things that the book of Joshua should teach us in a stark way. That's all we got. All right. So I've put up these questions here to kind of help us generate some discussion. If you guys have your own thoughts, of course, you're welcome to share them. But think about these two questions. How would someone identify a defining moment in their spiritual life? How would you know if this was like a really consequential decision that you were facing? And then second of all, what role should we play in helping others take big steps of faith? How do we do this together? You know, how do we go through this process, not just by ourselves, but together?
Yeah, God, this is actually kind of exciting. You know, I think one of the things that I remember being the most afraid of in my life when I was younger was the idea of having a boring life. when I think about how you bring us to these defining moments, these moments where it's like, yeah, this is scary. You know, this is what I do here could change everything. It's actually awesome, God, because to know that you have a life marked out for us, Lord, that's meaningful, that's significant, God, where you want us to do significant things to change other people's lives as well. And, God, I pray that if nothing else, you know, from these teachings in Joshua, that we would gain the courage, God, To take the steps of faith that you're putting in front of us, which we know many of those are unique, many of those are individual, but there's also things that you want us to do as a group, God, which could rock the foundations of our city. So we just pray, Father, that you would use us to do that. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.